It is time for the Media Beat with David Tarachuk. David joins us every Friday live here on The Breakfast Club. He also joins us after the noontime news on Mondays. We rebroadcast this also over the course of the weekend. David has his own website, which is themediabeat.us. He's also a PBS television correspondent reporting on ethics and belief. Good morning, David. How are you this morning?
Well, I'm well. I had a good night. I hope you did, too. Did you watch the great debate, the final head-to-head debate between the two candidates for president last night?
Absolutely not, simply because...
I had a feeling you'd say that.
Simply because I've made up my mind, and there's no reason for me to sit there and get hot under the collar when I've made up my mind. And
taking good care of your blood pressure makes total sense. And, of course, you know, you're amongst 50 million people who've done more than just make up their mind. They've actually cast their votes already. So it's a difficult thing to know how many people might have been swayed either way by last night's debate. But what was interesting about it, I think, is that it did actually end up being a bit more substantive than other efforts at getting the candidates to debate each other. Here's an interesting job description for you. Trump's handlers. Isn't that a wonderful job to apply for, being a handler for Donald J. Trump? Well, Trump's handlers did seem to get their way last night and did manage somehow or other to persuade him to restrain himself. He was a somewhat different performer last night, and we ended up with something more approaching what I think people think of as being a political debate. You and I agree, I think, generally that the debate is not a particularly useful format anyway for political discourse in this country, but it's become something of a gladiatorial spectacle. And of course, in the era of Trump, it's gotten to be a degrading gladiatorial spectacle. Last night was sort of pulled back a bit from those awful depths, but it was an exercise that was certainly bearable to watch. It was, I think, a lot of people's blood pressure would have been sent up, and it wasn't exactly polite discourse ever, really. But it was discourse that at times had meat to it, which is certainly different from previous examples.
Well, you're right. I looked at various news reports, everything from the BBC to NBC to Fox to ABC, you name it. I also looked at some video clips from it this morning preparing for the show. And at least you got a presentation of two candidates up there and why and how they are wildly different. Everything from their personalities to the way they talk about the future to the way they talk about the present. I mean, that's the one thing that I saw that you hadn't seen all year long with the debates is you actually saw two distinct different candidates and they couldn't be any farther from one another than they are. And the mute thing worked. They just have to expand it and work on it a little bit more. And just, you know, people tend to lose the fact that a debate is not meant to get personal. When I was in debate club, you had to study the facts, you had to write down the facts, you had to put together your case, you had to present it, and it had nothing to do with personality. It had to do with facts and with actual proposals. You got a little of that last night, but still, because it's a big media event, it's not really that heavy on facts and proposals for the future. Except
my take on it was that certainly one major thing had happened, where the implementation of the notion that a mute button could be used. It was only used in the candidates' opening statements to a particular new topic being introduced. The rest of the time, there were interruptions back and forth all the time, unmuted. But having the ground rule placed there seemed to make a difference, and it enabled, I believe, Kirsten Welker, who did overall a pretty good job, I thought, more than a pretty good job, in fact. She was at times very crisp and very much in control, in a way that put, the veteran, Chris Wallace, in the first disastrous debate to shame somewhat. But given the mute button as a basis for parts, at least, 2-minute sections, I guess 12 two-minute sections of the thing, so six topics, two candidates, there were 12 opportunities for candidates to speak totally uninterrupted by the other because the other is muted. That established a kind of basic ground rule which enabled Kirsten Welker to be as brisk as she was, and boy was she brisk sometimes with the candidates, moving them on. She was a little lazy in just saying every now and again, just your reaction, Mr. President, to something Biden had said, and your reaction, Mr. Vice President, to something Trump had said. One of the laziest forms of question asking on TV, I think. But she was nonetheless able to often just sum things up very briskly, say to one or the other, just answer this in 10 seconds and we'll move on, which is pretty good candidate wrangling, or her cat herding, or whatever is the appropriate label for what has to be done in these, as I say, totally artificial forums that pass for so-called political debate now.
And, you know, and I guess another reason I don't watch is because after the debate is over, there's the who won, and the who won circle of questions. And,
oh, the game analysis. Yeah.
Yeah, and I think more of an analysis of who won should be who presented their thoughts in a clearer manner. I mean,
and what those thoughts were. Yeah. I mean, particularly just be able to say after that debate, as I would if I were a viewer watching at home, I think, well, what did I get out of that? Well, you know, certain things were absolutely clear. Biden clarified, for instance, under pressure from Trump, but not unbearable pressure. He was adept and agile in responding to some of the outrageous stuff that Trump still came up with. But he was, for instance, able to clarify that he's totally in favor of private health insurance, whatever Trump may say. He's in favor of private health insurance alongside the public option that he wants for health insurance for the many people in this country who don't have it. So that was one example. And meanwhile, of course, on the other hand, I'd say as a viewer that I heard Trump say very firmly that the vaccine is ready for coronavirus. That, by the way, was the most meaty section of the entire six sections. And the man even said in front of millions of television viewers, I'm immune. And he repeated, of course, his old canard that no one has done more for the black community in America than Donald J. Trump, except Lincoln, of course. He was this time more openly prepared to admit that perhaps Abraham Lincoln exceeded him in this realm. So and it was interesting to see what he forgot to say also, what Trump did not say. He forgot that he'd brought the negotiations between the Democrats and the administration to a halt by ordering it on Twitter, a halt to the negotiations about COVID relief provision, the trillions of dollars that are needed to for this big opening up of the country that he talked about so fully, and yet said, in opposition to Biden, that the funds which were needed to be able to do that was something that in his, on his side of the ledger, he was not allowing. And of course, off stage, we know that negotiations are still being attempted, certainly between Speaker Pelosi from the House of Representatives and the Treasury Secretary. country. So we got a clear sense of what Trump didn't know, as well, or wasn't apparently aware of, or certainly wasn't going to talk about. And we had a clear idea of what Biden did want to say, and this time had very full opportunity to say it. But most of all, I think, and I you alluded to this, most of all, they were both, in a sense, quite clear about this. They were offering themselves as a study in two very different kinds of leader. And Biden, I think his advisors gave him exactly the right song sheet, if you like, to sing from, when he said essentially that just look at the two of us, please, just compare us to, as individuals, as men. And that, of course, is essentially now, if there are any people still wavering between the two, which one to vote for, that essentially is the criterion that everyone's going to apply, I think. It's not about individual pieces of policy, though it ought to be, of course. It's about which of these individuals do we feel safer with.
You know, looking at that, the one thing that I saw, one of the clips that I saw off there this morning was, once again, Donald Trump won't address the way COVID-19 has been handled, but he will blame it on China. And you can, if you want to stretch it and blame it on China, sure, of course, it appears it started in China and comes from China. But the way each individual country handles it is not the blame of China. It is the blame of whatever country is trying to handle it.
Sure. And as I say, the first, I think it probably lasted about 14-15 minutes, was entirely devoted to the handling of coronavirus, wherever it came from, of course. I mean, it's almost a pointless exercise to try and figure out whether it was truly China who gave it to us. Well, there's very little argument about where it came from. The real argument is about what you do with it once it's within your own shores. And, that essentially was the ground on which Biden drove in his own stake pretty clearly. I mean, he said anyone who allows 220,000 Americans to die on their watch doesn't deserve to be in office. That's a pretty simple and crude way of putting it, but it's essentially the one substantive issue in which he ought to be staking his claim to the office. And, you know, just by the way, as Trump will often say, by the way, at the end of the debate, another day had passed in which, in this case, in yesterday's case, 74,000 new cases of coronavirus were reported in this country. And that's the second highest daily total since the pandemic first began. We're looking at something that's extremely serious. We know that, though it seems that the chief executive currently in office tries to claim that it's not as serious as that.
Well, it's interesting that you bring that up, because on a local matter, we here are having a different outbreak than when COVID first came to our area. We just got off the phone with Mark Herko from Sherrod Hospital, the CEO, and our first experience with COVID was it coming in from the outside. Now, for the first time, we have community spread. Now, it's not, we don't know how widespread it is yet, but we have schools in Sharon, North Canaan, in Falls Village. We have a residential facility for seniors, Gear Village, Hotchkiss School, a private school, and also now for the first time, some doctors, some staff members, pardon me, at Sharon Hospital. So we are looking at this in a totally different way now, where we were kind of removed from it before, even though we followed the numbers. Now we have to follow the numbers because these numbers are coming from within our area, and it's a totally different disease when you look at it that way.
Yes, indeed. And the spikes that we're noticing around the country, particularly in the Midwest states, the northern Midwest states, the spiking there is primarily about community spread also. This may have been imported, but it's definitely a homegrown disease now. And how we maintain vigilance over it and over the changing nature of it in different areas is the issue ahead of us now. It's not a matter of opening up or not opening up. The sort of binary option that Trump appeared to be offering last night. What's clearly the matter going forward is what Trump and Biden were arguing about some of the time last night, which is Trump on the one hand saying that this is something we have to live with, an extraordinary proposition from a country leader, of course, and Biden saying, well, you know, the way it's being handled now means it's something that we're dying with. His claim that he's going to be much more resolute about controlling the spread of the disease, and of course, meanwhile, working every bit as hard as he needs to, his administration will need to if he's elected, and providing a vaccine and other measures to tamp it down. But providing this kind of choice is essentially what this election is about. I mean, there were other issues that came up too. It was heartening in a way, or at least it was at last somewhat satisfying to see that immigration got a full and substantial. The only time it was tackled head on as a stated topic for the debate in amongst last night's six topics. And so that was important to see, and to see that, you know, it revealed some interesting new thinking, or at least not so much new, but newly open proposition from Biden that, you know, he's not going to necessarily be the same guy that he was when he was vice president. He says, I was vice president then, now I'm going to be president, and I'll take a different line on deportations, for instance. But overall, it has to be said that the main terrain in which these final days of the campaign will be fought out will be on the handling of coronavirus. That's inevitable.
And what's interesting about it is when you look around the world, Scotland is now entering a five-tier brand-new program to deal with COVID. Also in France, 42 million people are going to be put under a much tighter watch. I mean,
nightly curfews in Paris, and unthinkable at one time in our history, wouldn't it be? But yes, you're absolutely right. Everyone across the world, I exaggerate, of course, but very broadly across the world, people are recognizing that it's not so much a second wave, but it's the disease taking a different form, a more widespread form, and a more, as you say, essentially internally spread disease, which needs constant vigilance and constant application of the basic principles of public health.
And what's interesting about COVID-19 is it's no longer even though they're running for president of the United States, it is no longer just a United States problem for who's going to be president. This is a policy that's going to have huge implications on foreign policy, how you deal with COVID in relation to our allies and other countries around the world. I mean, this COVID-19 becoming the mainstay of the political debate in this last two weeks is interesting in itself, because there's so many other situations around the world. But really, it is a topic that is not only for domestic concern, but our defenses and our foreign policy.
Well, it's not called a pandemic for nothing. It is everywhere. So that logically follows. In some strange way, it's almost a return to a time when the known world was much smaller. It's as if we're back in medieval times and the Black Death has taken over the entire world. I mean, I exaggerate for effect there, but we are talking about something which is truly international, and the solutions will have to be truly international too. And meanwhile, yet again, you have a very very stark contrast between two ways to approach that. An internationally minded Joe Biden, who talks about multilateral efforts and collaboration and cooperation between nations, and Trump, who is still, even in a case which is so obviously international and multifaceted and globalized, still talks about putting America first. I can imagine if we do have Trump as a president still, there will be horribly squalid fights over, there would be horribly squalid fights over who owns the virus and how it is to be distributed worldwide, and whose antivirus vaccine is to be trusted. Is the new Russian one really going to be taken up by other countries, is the American one going to be used as some kind of weapon for sometimes giving it to friends and not giving it to people who are perceived as enemies? This is all the kind of thing that you can imagine going on when you have a disjointed international approach. And what I would suggest is needed, and I think most public health experts would agree on this, what is needed is a wholly international approach to a wholly international problem.
Absolutely. And one thing I was surprised when I woke up and I saw the reference to Abe Lincoln in the debate, I was surprised that Joe Biden didn't pull out a Lloyd Benson line saying, Mr. President, I knew.
We all know Abe Lincoln, and you are no Abe Lincoln.
But he could have made fun of the age factor by saying
that. Yeah. Yes, that's a line that the Biden team didn't offer his their leader to try on. But it could have been effective.
Well, it was like when Ronald Reagan made his age turned it from a deficit to a positive. He could have said, you know, speaking about our age, Mr. Trump, I knew Abe Lincoln, and you're no Abe Lincoln. It would have added a lighthearted reference.
And I'm not going to take advantage of your inexperience. Yeah.
<That's right. laughs> Well, so that's
the characterization on Trump's side. I mean, he was careful to characterize himself differently from Biden too. He didn't say whether Biden was, very open about saying, "Hey, look at the character of these two people in front of you. There's me and there's him." Trump was going back to some basics that he used in 2016 as well, saying that he's a newcomer, he's an outsider, although he's been in office now for almost 4 years, but he's saying that that's nothing compared with a man who has been on the political scene for 47 years and not gotten the things done that he's claiming now he will get done. That's all fair in politics and war, of course. That's a reasonable accusation to make, and people can weigh up that statement for themselves and see what it's worth.
Well, with COVID-19 and foreign policy, we just never got a chance to see what both people think about what's going on in Nigeria. Also, Libya signing their ceasefire deal. I mean, there's a lot going on in the world that the U.S. president, if we get re-involved in the world, is going to have to deal with.
Yeah. By the way, I think it's time that we brought back our feature of the fanfare. Someone actually deserves it this week,
okay,
in this context that we're talking about. Can we hear the fanfare?
I think we can do this, absolutely.
Yes, let's hear it for Kirsten Welker, the NBC White House correspondent and Weekend Today anchor, who moderated last night's debate. I'm not going to say she was perfect. Far from it. There were things about her approach that I didn't care for and could have been more professional. I didn't like, for instance, the way that she so obviously looked down at her notes for a long time, reading very nicely constructed questions, but they were obviously so written, and it felt a little stagey. But the point is that she was a good herder of the political cats on stage. She was a brisk motivator of both parties to keep moving and not get involved in the horrible spats that so disfigured the first presidential debate. And she was, as I say, better than Chris Wallace at moving things along and keeping them on the straight and narrow. And somehow or other, with the, you know, with the help of the muting button and the help of Trump's team in deciding on a new strategy anyway, a little calmer. But most of all, I think she deserves it for the final question, just asking each candidate to say what they would say when they were being inaugurated, if they're inaugurated on January 23rd. What do you say to the people who didn't vote for you? It was a very telling question, and there were very telling responses. Trump just chose to attack Biden again, and Biden chose to say, look, I'm going to be president for all of you, and I'm the kind of guy that you know, and I will be president for people who didn't vote for me, and that's essentially, you know, a reasonable and sensible pitch to make.
And one thing I'll just say, and to wrap up our talk about the debate, is you can never judge the effect of mayhem on people, but when you get two candidates up there that are so totally different from the way they present themselves, to their mannerisms, to the way they talk, it really was a very revealing, from the clips I saw, very revealing for both men. And you can see why Donald Trump has some of his hardcore supporters, and you can see the difference that a Joe Biden would make. It was a very, very stark contrast between the two.
Yeah. Absolutely, and in that, you know, in as much as that was achieved, it was a success. It was a vivid illustration of the choices of the essential choice before us.
Well, is there anything that we might have missed this morning?
I have a cough, but I don't think I have a virus. I just want to put a bit in for saying that I'm still healthy and I'm going to hold out until the end of this election campaign.
Well, David, it's always great to talk to you. It's always great to get your input and your view on exactly what's going on, not in the world, but also the way the media covers it. And I guess we'll wait and see what happens next week when we once again gather on a Friday morning.
Getting ever closer to the ultimate day of decision, November the 3rd, absolutely.
All right, David, have a great week.
You too.
David Taraczuk with the Media Beat here on Robin Hood Radio. You can also find David at robinhoodradio.com. Click on David Taraczuk and the Media Beat on the on-demand page.